Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an entrepreneur and financial specialist, Henry Schoenberger, the author of a new book, How We Got Swindled by Wall Street Godfathers, Greed and Financial Darwinism, The 30-Year War Against the American Dream. We will discuss the great swindle now going on in plain sight every time you fill up at the gas pump, where in spite of a global oversupply of oil, prices are being driven up by Wall Street speculators, while our press and politicians distract us with rumors of war and lame excuses. Then we will be joined in the studio by the filmmakers of an epic documentary feature, Shadows of Afghanistan, 1959 to 2012, which tells the story of the modern history of Afghanistan, where we have been engaged in America's longest war and still know little about this country and its people. Producer-directors Jim Burrows and Suzanne Berman join us. Then finally, we will discuss what more is at stake in Syria other than the fate of a dictator and the lives of its people trying to overthrow the Assad regime. And that is the fate of Responsibility to Protect, or R2P, at the United Nations, where, under its charter's state sovereignty provision, nothing can be done to stop the Syrian government from killing its people. A former policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico Military Affairs at the Department of State, Bennett Ramberg, joins us. He has an article at Politico, "The World Must Stop Syrian Slaughter." And joining us now is Henry Schoenberger, who's an entrepreneur, financial specialist, writer, and author. His books include Invest for Success, How to Avoid Getting Ripped Off by Real Estate Partnerships, the Stock Market, and Diversification. And his latest book just out is How We Got Swindled by Wall Street Godfathers, Greed and Financial Darwinism, The 30-Year War Against the American Dream. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Schoenberger.
Well, I'm lucky to be here.
And it seems, though, in terms of your new book, How We Got Swindled by Wall Street Godfathers, Greed and Financial Darwinism, we're getting swindled today. I mean, every time you pull up at the pump, you're paying for the Wall Street speculators who are really behind the high price of gas. It's not the fear premium from a threat of war with Iran in the Middle East. It's absolutely unequivocally what's happening is Wall Street speculation. Between 80 and 90% of the futures contracts for oil and gas are being bought by speculators, not by the end users like refineries and airlines.
Absolutely.
Why isn't this being discussed?
Well, it's just more of the same. The real core problems are not being discussed in this country. I think a lot of members of the media are earnest, but they don't know enough about some of these things, and then they have culprits from the past, economists that were cheerleaders for greed. They have them on as experts, and they might know a lot, but they also were paid consultants to Wall Street and bribed them, basically as a bribe. And, I mean, Greenspan is one of the leading culprits. Wrote about financial instruments, how it was going to be a terrific thing for this for our economy, and he had to know that was a lie. And so we're still in the same moment where Wall Street circulates ruses to justify sociopathic greed, basically. And I've written about this in a number of chapters in the book. I mean, I've even detailed, there's something called the Commodities Futures Modernization Act, which Clinton signed into law. It was attached to an 11,000-page, I think it was called an omnibus appropriation bill. And, I mean, that basically allowed the kinds of trades that are being done in oil futures to be conducted without anybody seeing them. But even if somebody does see them, who is going to control it? I mean, the financial reform and the Volcker Rule and the things that are in there are meaningless because it's talking about improving compliance, and the SEC has not stopped all the illegal financial innovation that's been contrived to create fees. That's illegal under certain specific regulations that the SEC has, as well as the Fed Bank Holding Company regulations. Illegal. And I specified what the actual regulations are that were violated and explained simply why it constitutes a violation of law and why it's illegal. Fraud. But when Wall Street makes this kind of money, and there's so much money going into the government to get people reelected, I guess that's, you know, the fundamental problem. And you know, to go back to the oil and gas, you're exactly right. Exactly right.
Well, but what it shows, and this is a pattern that goes back to the subprime meltdown, Henry Schoenberger, is that Wall Street has created its own little world, its own little rules, its own little private casinos where only the super wealthy can get to gamble. But they do so at the expense of the average American citizen. And when the gambling gets out of hand and the greed overwhelms them all, then they go bust. The poor beleaguered taxpayer then bails them out. I mean, it's an extraordinary situation, and I just don't understand how incredibly passive the American people are, that maybe it's that they just don't realize every time they go to the gas station lately, they're contributing to these parasites on Wall Street.
Well, they are, and I can't understand. I'm confounded by all, by how passive people are, but I also do believe that a lot of people, Americans really are not very well informed. Americans don't. I mean, I've got two really bright daughters. They wouldn't take economics. I force-fed them something that Lester Thoreau and Robert Heilbronner read, making Economics Simple, which should be required reading for everybody in this country. It's a terrific book. He was the dean of economics at MIT. But I think the bottom line is, I wrote about this in my book too. We allow language to shape our thoughts instead of use it to elicit thought, which is what it's supposed to be used for. And so people somehow just accept credentials, or if somebody is really wealthy, they listen to what they have to say rather than stopping to think about it. So I think maybe critical thought is missing in our country, in this country. I don't know how it is in Australia or how it is in England, but I cannot understand how people can just roll over and take this without getting mad.
Again, I'm speaking with Henry Schoenberger, the author of the new book, How We Got Swindled by Wall Street Godfathers, Greed and Financial Darwinism, The 30-Year War Against the American Dream. And you're suggesting...
Wait, Ian, can I interrupt you?
Sure.
One thing is, you're exactly right. If people can't get what's going on from what's going on with gas prices, how are they going to focus on the idea that there could be $700 trillion of derivatives looming over our economy, like a hydrogen bomb, or maybe over the world? And there is a distinction between, this is something else I talk about in my book, and you're actually right on the mark on this thing, that the speculation doesn't create any real investment. It doesn't create anything positive except fees for the speculators. And so since 1987, I started talking about it, we have turned from real investment to financial investment. Financial investment only creates fees for the people who are speculating. Real investment creates capital formation, which does do things for the economy. It does create jobs. And Wall Street formerly used to, fund companies that were startups to create, real capital formation. It hasn't done that for I don't know how long.
Well, in general, I think in a broad sense, what's happening, and I think you could argue that American capitalism is in crisis because it's the financial sector is over 40% of the total economy, and the financial sector, the Wall Street casinos, basically are all about extracting wealth, not creating wealth, which was, of course, the original idea of capital formation and investment.
You're exactly right. Exactly right.
So your new book, How We Got Swindled by Wall Street Godfathers, Greed and Financial Darwinism, The 30-Year War Against the American Dream, it takes the position that we have a kind of financial version of social Darwinism out there, financial Darwinism,
right.
And it's based upon the notion of survival of the richest.
Right. Well, the foreword was written by David Satterfield, who formerly was the business editor of the Miami Herald and has two Pulitzers. And then after that, he became the managing editor of, I think it's called the Mercury News, which is more in your neighborhood.
San Jose, yeah.
Yeah, and then he left journalism because he became, I don't want to quote David, but there just aren't a lot of people left in the print media that are really investigative financial journalists that really know what's wrong, and then the newspapers don't even want to print it.
They don't want
to alarm the public, maybe because they're dependent on banks. I really don't understand how, where the Fourth Estate, I mean, as you well know, the mission of the Fourth Estate, which is the press, the media, is to objectively create informed public opinion. And so I think there's also been a breakdown of the Fourth Estate's role in this process of creating objective public opinion.
Well, it's just incomprehensible to me, though, that the gasoline story, which is being presented every day on local news and in the press, and it's all, a kind of sleight of hand, a distraction. First of all, the context is never mentioned that OPEC says that there's a worldwide glut, a surplus of supply.
Because people are using less gas because they don't have enough money to pay for it.
And we also have the same condition in the United States.
Right.
And that, furthermore, American oil companies are exporting more gasoline than they ever have.
Right.
Those are the external conditions. And then you say to yourself, well, how come, if that's the situation, gas should be an all-time low, and then why is it high? Well, because of Iran. And people just are satisfied with that explanation. I spoke with the former head of markets and trading at the Commodities Future Trading Commission just the other day.
Uh-huh.
And that's what he's in his professional life. He's been there, done it. And he says it's all about speculation. It happened before, back in summer of 2008, when gasoline got up to the $147 a barrel.
Right.
And 60 Minutes blew the whistle on that one. And it turns out that Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase and these other banks had more oil than Exxon has ever had in its existence.
They
have tankers going around in circles. Now you have...
waiting for the price to go up.
So this is an amazing scandal, yet, you know, who the hell's talking about it?
But you know what this also shows this country, if they want to think about it? It shows that there is no protection for consumers. The SEC is worse than morally bankrupt. Mary Shapiro ran the NESD. I owned a broker dealer. I have a licensing. If I said this before, I apologize. I have a Series 39 license from the SEC. I've had it for years. I have a licensing of a compliance officer. They do not protect the public. They protect the markets, which means the market makers, which means the wealthiest people on the street who want to just have a huge velocity of computer trades or highly speculative. Highly speculative endeavors to make money. Period.
So, and why did Obama appoint Mary Shapiro?
Well, as you can imagine, I am not a Tea Party person, and there is no way I would vote for any one of these idiots in the Republican primary or like that. But why did he do that? I don't know, and I talked about that in the book. It doesn't make sense that he would have appointed culprits from the past. Geithner didn't do anything specifically wrong, but he did participate in making the investment banks bank holding companies as the president of the Fed, which made him the vice chairman of the Fed nationally. I mean, he put that through. And the president of the Fed was a former management committee member. I don't remember exactly what, and I don't remember the guy's name. I have all these names in my head. Was a top guy at Goldman. Paulson was an ex-CEO from Goldman. Rubin, who was with Secretary of Treasury under Clinton, was an ex-CEO from Goldman. And then Rubin joined Greenberg at Citi to petition the government to deregulate. So, I mean, the real problem is you cannot unlock greed and let it out of its cage. You can't be a compliance officer and control greed, and they haven't done much of a job anyway. And I've even quoted what Mary Shapiro says is the mission of the SEC, and that's to protect the markets. But that is code for protecting the pockets of Wall Street people.
Instead of being the cop on the beat, which is the original intention of
the original intention,
of
which
the
is
SEC.
Why they appointed Joe Kennedy to be the first guy in charge of the SEC.
And then even under Bush, Donaldson was doing a good job, but then Bush probably got pressure from Wall Street to get rid of him, and he brought in Christopher Cox, who was a complete catastrophe.
Oh.
And then you had the 2008 crash, and then you'd think after that they'd bring in a real cop on the beat, but instead Obama appoints Mary Shapiro.
Yeah, I think Donaldson did have ethics.
Yeah, he did. By the way, while this is all happening, thousands of or hundreds of FBI agents trained in white-collar crime after 9/11 are diverted to chasing terrorists. And thus we have the Bernie Madoffs and others like that running free. You mentioned a little while ago, Henry, this huge looming derivatives balloon that's out there, the other 900-pound gorilla in the living room after the speculation that's driving up the price of gas.
Right.
I recall that Warren Buffett some years back referred to derivatives as financial weapons of mass destruction. I take it you agree with that?
I could not agree with that more.
So what's the ticking bomb then? Tell us about that.
Well, the ticking bomb is that if you have... one P under a pod. Shell game? This is is my explanation in the book, and it's hard to explain something that isn't real. If you have one pea and then you've got 40 more shells on top of that one pod, that one pea, based on the value of that one pea, ostensibly, and if one little hiccup happens with that pea, the whole damn thing falls. It's an inverted pyramid. And so, basically, the value that is underlying all of its derivative is something that's a function of something else. Sort of hard to explain when you turn it into an investment, which is BS. But the bottom line is, one little hiccup in the virtual value, like the housing market not going up 1% every year, starting to fall. Boom, there it goes. And it wasn't just houses that did this. All kinds of debt. And let me ask you a question. I mean, you know a lot about financial stuff. How can you call something collateral when it's not collateral that any bank in the world would accept? And yet all of these things are supposedly collateralized by additional debt that can't even be measured, all different kinds of debt, not just Freddie and Fannie debt, but other tranches full of debt. Now, how is it legal to call something collateral when it's not collateral?
It's a form of alchemy, isn't it?
Well, it's a form of alchemy. My first book, I talked about how all the people with PhDs in finance were trying to turn lead into gold.
Well, tell me what can be done, and I know your book deals with this, Henry Schoenberger, again, the author of How We Got Swindled by Wall Street Godfathers, Greed and Financial Darwinism, the 30-Year War Against the American Dream, because it seems so overdue that we should have a national debate and not about birth control and homeschooling and the insanity that's going on in the Republican campaign at the moment, but really talk about whether we're still a democracy, whether we've become a plutonomy ruled by financial oligarchs and, you know, inherited wealth and hedge funds people. And they've even got the gall to run one of their own as for president.
Right. Disgusting.
Mitt Romney, who's an archetype of what we've been talking about. What's
Absolutely.
Wrong with American capitalism? He's one of these extraction specialists who just strip companies bare, takes huge fees, and the people left running these companies have no room to maneuver because they've got this looming debt, which is largely to do with the money that was borrowed to do the leverage buyout in the first place. And then on top of that, all of the profits go into fees for Mitt Romney and his time for years and years. And guess what? They only pay 15% tax on it.
Right. Well, Mitt Romney is the kind of venture capitalist or equity investor that makes the guys who are trying to start companies and trying to produce capital formation look lousy. I mean, there are some people out there that really are trying to form new companies. And of course, that means more jobs and more security for people and a better economy. But, I wrote the book because people just don't seem to understand what's going on. And since I'm inside this, and I have no guilt to confess because I've never recommended financial instruments, somebody had to say something. I wrote a book about it in 1990, so I decided, well, I guess it's going to have to be me. And I did was actually major in econ by accident and believe some of the stuff I learned in the early 60s and watched it and watched people destroy it because it worked. Now, if you're asking me what we need to do, first of all, Americans need to know more. They have to arm themselves with enough knowledge to understand how they're getting screwed by the oil prices. But I think Americans really need to know a little bit more, which is why I wrote my book. And then the next thing is, you cannot get greed to comply with Volcker rules or any of the kind of strange, fallacious approach to allowing market makers to continue to speculate in financial investments which don't produce anything productive and that take capital out of the capital formation process, as you've explained.
Well, but could we have a situation, though, where we have a kind of, maybe this is a fantasy, but have some kind of citizens' tribunal where the very people who are getting gouged at the pump and at a kitchen table through this a license to steal through the commodities exchange, that, by the way, the index was developed by Goldman Sachs. It's called the Goldman Sachs Index.
Of course.
So
what else is new? They've infiltrated the government for 30 years.
But the notion, though, that the educational process should be to put these Wall Street titans and the American oligarchs on trial and have them justify what they do in terms of societal good. And what is the purpose of what they're doing? The purpose of what they're doing is to make themselves richer. And that's what your thesis is, right? It's financial Darwinism, survival
right.
of the richest.
That's right. It is financial Darwinism. And the reason why it's not social Darwinism is because you're not calling the troops to come and shoot people who are striking for a little bit more money, as Andrew Carnegie did in 1892 when he had a steel strike, and he called the National Guard. They sent 8,000 people or 8,000 troops, and six people wound up shot and dead. And that, of course, stopped the union movement. Then the union movement, you know, got a little carried away, too, where the union bosses might have been equally as bad as some of the big bosses of companies. And the union movement sank backwards a little bit. But still, the only way an individual can make manifest their needs and wants is through a collectivity. So, I mean, if you're saying that we should have a citizens' council set up, what a great idea. How are you going to figure out who should be on the council?
Well, I'm just wondering.
If they only pick people that have PhDs in econ, and economics happens to be, as I'm sure you know, a philosophy. It's not a science. All the quadrants turns people off. All the math, it turns people off. There are some postulates that make sense. Certainly not laissez-faire and maximize. Well, the other problem, too, is not just unfettered greed. It's also the theory of the profit of maximization left over from a guy named Schumpeter that was picked up by the social Darwin guy that had nothing to do with Darwin at all. But it was picked up by a guy named Herbert Spencer in the late 19th century to give a moral ethic to the robber barons to be sociopathic, greedy people. It gave them their ethic to survive.
Well, and Ron Paul's a great follower of him, and you can throw Ayn Rand into the mix as well. So again, though, Henry Schoenberger, I know the idea of a citizens' tribunal is pie in the sky, but I'm trying to figure out a way to burst this bubble that the public is in the thrall of wealthy people in this country, but they don't realize that we've created a kind of parasitic system where the wealthy are extracting wealth for themselves at the expense of everybody else and of the expense of the overall U.S. economy.
Ian, I got to stop you. That's a perfect description. Parasites.
Well, but that's...
That's perfect. And why do we allow that? Because people swallow propaganda from Wall Street. We have the wrong people in the media that don't know what you know. We need more people in the media like you. Satterfield knows too. He got out. I don't know who in the press says is as knowledgeable as you are and says what you're saying. And I read all this. I think Chris Hayes on Up with Chris Hayes is a very smart young guy. I mean, you know, and I think the people on MSNBC care. Some of them know more than others. But I think the real problem is a lack of education, maybe. Maybe, what do you think? Elementary school, high school, people need to know a little bit about how to protect themselves from parasites?
Well, but you bring up the American dream. The subtitle of your book is The 30-Year War Against the American Dream.
Right.
So the real inquisition that should take place in the Citizens' Tribunal is in defense of the American dream and in defense of whether we have, as a people, have a delusional ideology and ethos and mystique and myth that we live by, that through hard work you can attain the American dream. After all, it's in the Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of happiness. And you cannot pursue happiness if the game is rigged against you.
You can't. And also Jefferson said, he didn't say, I'm paraphrasing him, that the role of government is to protect the public. The government's supposed to get involved when the public needs to be protected. And where's the government been? You know, all of these things are coming to the forefront. This is the second worst economy since 1776. And regardless of whether the media is talking about, well, the unemployment's down a little bit, what is real unemployment? What's really happening? How many lives have really been devastated by what's going on? And, obviously this upsets me, and I can tell it upsets you, too. And we need more people who are on the air all the time and who write about it. We just do.
Well, Henry, I thank you for joining us here today.
All right. Thank you very much for having me, and I appreciate it, too.
Again, Henry Schoenberger is an entrepreneur, financial specialist, writer, and author. His books include Invest for Success, How to Avoid Getting Ripped Off by Real Estate Partnerships, The Stock Market, and Diversification. And his latest book just out is How We Got Swindled by Wall Street Godfathers, Greed and Financial Darwinism, The 30-Year War Against the American Dream. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking with the filmmakers of a new documentary about the history of Afghanistan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio are Jim Burrows and Suzanne Bauman, the filmmakers of Shadows of Afghanistan, 1959 to 2012. Jim Burrows is a producer, director, and cameraman who has filmed on six continents, documenting wars, expeditions, profiling artists, and political leaders. His companion book to Shadow of Afghanistan, Blood on the Lens, will soon be out in a new updated edition. And Suzanne Bauman is a producer, director of more than 80 documentary films and series. She produced and directed Jackie Behind the Myth, a two-hour special on Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis for PBS, and is now producing and directing The Writing Code, a series about the history of writing from ancient times to the internet. They both were nominated for an Academy Award for Cuban Odyssey and received an Oscar of Special Merit for La Belle Epoque. Separately and together, they have produced films and television programs for PBS, ABC, A&E, and Channel 4 UK. Together, they produced Water Wars, When Droughts Flood, and Greed Collide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Burrows and Suzanne Bauman.
Hey, thank you.
And the documentary, of course, is a very necessary and needed history of a country that the history, of course, precedes our history. And we've had the two periods in the 80s, where we were fighting the Soviets through the Afghans, and then since 2001, where we have been at war or nation building, and this will be the longest war in the U.S. history. But let's go back to just, Suzanne, to the beginning of the film, which it's almost a different century, but it's not. It's just, you know, from 59 up until the Soviet war, this was a functioning country.
It was a functioning country, and we begin with 1959 because it's the first time that an American president ever visited Afghanistan, and that was Dwight Eisenhower. And we found the footage of his visit, and given the fact of the Taliban atrocities of stopping all kinds of entertainment or ability to dance, I mean, there's this fabulous sequence of where he's there watching Sufi dancers twirling and people just joyous in the look of this. This was not made up, you know.
Right. Well,
and
also,
even though it was a rough time in history, Cold War going on, everything else. I mean, this was a different country altogether from.
Well, but there wasn't, in a way, the king was in the catbird seat because he could play the Americans up against the Russians. He was being wooed by both.
He was, and he insisted on being neutral.
Well, there was a certain point where there was no choice of neutrality when Daoud was murdered. Daoud was his nephew, I guess, and he took over the presidency from Zahir Shah and tried to work more with the Soviets. Then he found that the people were really not liking this one damn bit, and that got him in big trouble. And as people say, a lot of experts, when things happen in Afghanistan, they happen fast. When Amanullah was back in the early part of the century, was bringing a lot of Western advances to Afghanistan, well, they liked this at first, but it was too fast. And all of a sudden, one day, it just caught fire all across the country, and Amanullah was out of a job. So things do happen fast, and I think that's one of the things that we have a tendency to look at them as, well, they're just there, and they're trying to learn how to fight, trying to make a living. If these people had gotten some of the money that was promised them, so they could rebuild their electricity, clean water, there's no clean water. No hot water. The roads are a little better, but if you don't know that road and you're driving at night, you're in trouble.
Again, I'm joined in the studio by Jim Burrows and Suzanne Bauman, the filmmakers of Shadow of Afghanistan. And you talked about your friend Lee Shapiro, who was trying to film Massoud. What will the situation be like in 2014 when the U.S. pulls out? If the lines are drawn again, you say that the country's fabric has been torn, that there's no national identity left. Will we have another Massoud? He'll be the surrogate for who? The United States, Iran, and Russia, right?
Russia will be back in the game, of
course. But on the side of the Northern Alliance.
Well, there may not be... The Northern Alliance may not be as strong in this coming period.
So what would be the configuration of a new civil war? You'll have the Pashtuns and the Taliban on one side, right?
Well, the Pashtuns, the bulk of the Taliban are Pashtuns. And there is something very... In 1893, the British drew a boundary across the mountains of the Hindu Kush, which was supposed to separate British India from Afghanistan. So they simply divide and conquer. This is their way of doing it. And what they did was separate families and tribal peoples right along that line. And to this day, you have the Pashtuns who are split. Some of them are in Afghanistan. Some of them are in Pakistan. But the bulk of them are in the south. Well, if Rashid is right and the fabric has been torn irreparably, you're not going to find the Tajiks and the Shias and the Pashtuns getting back together. And I guess that's my greatest fear, is that they won't be able to get back together. And I think that Pakistan, they have always wanted to make sure that nobody knew that before 1947, the borders of Afghanistan included the cities of Quetta, the borders of, in other words, Afghanistan maintained Peshawar, it maintained Quetta, they even claimed Rawalpindi. So in a sense, what's happened is that Pakistan wants to keep a kind of a confusion going here, because they could lose a tremendous amount of their territory if it ever went to a world court. So I think Pakistan is a huge key in this whole thing. It would be a civil war, and then Pakistan would come in to participate. That will be the way it is.
In a way to keep Afghanistan as weak as possible.
Yeah.
So I think it's not just Pashtuns. You know, all Pashtuns are not
Taliban
by any means. That's a misconception in this country.
Right, but my understanding is that Afghans don't particularly like Pakistanis, and yet they're being dominated and manipulated by them. Is that true?
Yes, and they haven't. They never realized this until maybe the last 10 years. Now the hatred is enormous in Afghanistan among, let's say, Tajiks and the. And the Pashtuns who are working with the government and not with the Taliban.
Yeah, complete distrust.
Here's an interesting thing. I'll never forget it. November 27, 28. Most of the reporters were staying at this hotel, Spingar in Jalalabad, out of safety. In one part, and another part because they didn't know, there was very little knowledge of the country they were dealing with. So we went out with a facilitator who was really good and a few armed men. And everywhere we went, people were smiling, happy. Even places where there had been accidents and some of the bombs had killed people in the village, they were just full of smiles, love, thank you, getting us out of this terrible mess.
This is to the Americans coming in after
9/11. In 2001.
Yeah.
And no one knows that now, or if they did, they've forgotten it, because the enthusiasm of those people when we first arrived was enormous.
Yeah, genuine.
And they thought we were going to bring them a democracy like we had. And
maybe not like we had, but certainly an end to the war and the persecution by these extreme Taliban measures.
Right. And the economic deprivation too, right?
Absolutely.
Because I remember Mike Hoover telling me that the Afghans people were saying they felt that Americans had liberated them.
Yes.
And they thought, well, you know, if the Americans can put a man on the moon, they can sure as hell fix our downtrodden country.
Right. Get our wells clean and
then,
again.
And then what happened?
Well, we were taken
the
into
money
a
all
war
went into
that
military.
Was not necessary.
Yeah.
An unnecessary
yeah.
war.
Right.
Get rid of that.
Yeah. So just in closing then, tell us, starting with you, Suzanne, tell us why you made the film and why our audience need to get a copy of your film.
The beginning of really wanting to finish this film was way back in the 80s, seeing this incredible footage of these beautiful people in refugee camps with still maintaining their dignity, struggling to survive, trying to keep their children alive. And many of them had come from, just running away from war. So, I mean, I hadn't ever seen such moving footage. So it was just little children wounded in the snow and families struggling to get their babies and their goats on a truck just to survive. Like, what will they do to survive? And the incredible tenacity, survival instinct of these people. I was so moved by it, I just was practically in tears watching it. So that's a long time ago. Then comes the long march of, well, how do we get the completion money for this? No one in this, you go apply for grants or go to PBS and your standard routes. No one even knew how to spell Afghanistan in 1987. And much less, it's like, who cares? They just couldn't get it. And so we just kept going back and finding ways to either try to get British television to air it or American. And the phone started ringing off the wall after 9/11. Everybody who had ever known what we were doing then said, you've got to finish this film. And of course we did. We had to finish the film. And and also we said, God, we knew that this was going to come around. And Massoud, in one of his last speeches in France, he said as a warning, if you don't listen to what's happening in Afghanistan, it's going to come back to haunt you.
Right.
And that became like a key. And then we knew, we opened the paper. It's like, oh, my God, they just assassinated Massoud. And the next thing you know,
9/11
happened.
It was all so perfectly timed.
We always knew that those were connected events.
Well,
had to finish it. Had to finish the story because it affects
right.
us.
But the story takes us up to the present.
Yes,
it does. And that's the point. And so just in closing, Jim Burrows, tell our audience why they should get this film and why they need to see this film.
Well, I think that, it's a corny statement, and Americans, I guess, don't like to hear it all that much. But if you don't know the history, if you don't know how the bad guys got in power in the first place, and if you don't know where they got their money and who paid them and who supported who.
Armed them. Yeah.
Armed them. How can you possibly understand what's going on now? Is this going to be a powder keg that is the thing that the straw that breaks the camel's back? I don't think so.
This current
situation here,
Quran.
Any more than the Marines peeing on corpses. But it's heading in the wrong direction because there's a split between those people that smiled so happily at me and any military I was with in 2001, 2002. They're not smiling now.
Well, I thank you both for joining us here today in the studio, Jim Burrows and Suzanne Bauman, the filmmakers of Shadow of Afghanistan, 1959 to 2012.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Jim Burrows, who's a producer, director, and cameraman who's filmed on six continents, documenting wars, expeditions, profiling artists and political leaders. His companion book, Two Shadows of Afghanistan, is Blood on the Lens. It'll be out soon in a new updated edition. And Suzanne Bauman is producer, director of more than 80 documentaries and series. She produced and directed Jackie Behind the Myth, a two-hour special on Jacqueline Kennedy and Onassis for PBS, and is now producing and directing The Writing Code, a series about the history of writing from ancient times to the internet. They were both nominated for an Academy Award for Cuban Odyssey and received an Oscar of Special Merit for the La Belle Époque. Separately and together, they produce films and television programs for PBS, ABC, A&E, and Channel 4 UK. And together they produced Water Wars, When Drought, Flood, and Greed Collide. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about intervening in Syria.
بتشاير في وانا صدري كل الظهرك عنده حكي جري قدامك شخص غريب من وين جيت من وين نبات بالمدينة انتشر فيها العب والحب حب الخلايا نامت وما عدت فيه اشريت من رواية الحي نظيف الكل يوم شوف فيه زبالة والأوسخ عم تلعب على الطريق شوف في ناس ما
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bennett Ramberg, who was formerly a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs at the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of the book Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy and Unrecognized Military Peril. And he has an article at Politico, The World Must Stop Syrian Slaughter. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bennett Ramberg.
Well, thank you, Ian.
And your article at Politico basically is arguing that there's a lot more at stake in Syria than the future of the country and its dictator and the people that are being killed by the dictatorship and fighting for their freedom. Close to 8,000, 7,500 people have died at the hands of the security forces. That's probably an underestimation given that there's no press allowed in there. But what is protecting Assad is the UN's charter that basically has this state sovereignty provision that basically allows Assad to get away with murder.
That's right. Under Article 2 of the UN Charter, states are sovereign. They can do what they want within their borders. And the international community cannot intervene, even though a dictator or a leader may be slaughtering his people.
And
it's quite astonishing, but understandable at the time the Charter was inaugurated. The question is, should we modify that provision today? And there's efforts afoot to do so.
Well, just in terms of dictators who slaughtered their own people, there have been more deaths in these wars that we've seen within these countries than there have been from wars involving, you know, say foreign invaders, for example. Sudan from 55 to 72, estimated 500,000 have been killed. In Indonesia, 65 to 1966, 400,000 died. Uganda from 72 to 79, estimated 300,000 were killed. Cambodia from 75 to 79, an estimated 2.5 million died. And in post-war Vietnam from 75 on 365,000. And in Iraq from 79 to 2003, an estimated...
Isn't that astonishing? Doesn't it say it all?
Well,
the international community has failed.
Totally, but it's, at least the Canadians woke up in about 2000 and spurred on by the tragedies in Rwanda and Bosnia, and they convened an international commission on intervention and state sovereignty, out of which they produced this report called Responsibility to Protect, or R2P. So tell us about R2P and where it stands.
Well, this convention of former diplomats and others try to address the question whether the time has come for the international community to review its the sovereignty provision in the United Nations Charter, and to ask themselves whether it's time for when countries are slaughtering their own people, leaders are slaughtering their own people, murdering their own people, whether the international community ought to intervene. And they were driven by Rwanda. 800,000 people lost their lives, and what happened in the former Yugoslavia as well. And they came to the conclusion and authored a doctrine called Responsibility to Protect. And I would urge all of your leaders to go onto the web and read this remarkable document. They encourage the international community to look again at this particular issue of internal matters that result in the mass murder of populations and ask themselves whether the United Nations should, in point of fact, intervene into the affairs of states when crimes against humanity are being committed.
So in 2005, a world summit was convened, right? And this is the largest gathering of leaders in history at the United Nations General Assembly. What happened?
Well, this was, as you said, the largest convocation, and the statesmen did agree in principle that there should be a new prescription by the United Nations which would address issues of genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity committed by leaders against their own countries. And they asked the General Assembly to consider the matter, and the General Assembly picked up the matter in 2009. And spent 2 days on the issue. There was a lot of bickering, and nothing occurred.
So is that to do with the fact that a lot of the General Assembly members are thugs? And
well, it was that, arguably, but more they were bickering about all sorts of issues in this context. How many members there should be on the Security Council, how many permanent members ought to be on the Security Council, shall we revise the Security Council? So all sorts of ancillary issues came up during this discussion. And since 2009, the matter was not considered again. But then came Libya.
So, Libya again, let's stop you for a second and remind the audience I'm speaking with Bennett Ramberg, who was formerly a foreign policy analyst at the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs of the Department of State under the George H.W. Bush administration. He has an article at Politico, "The World Must Stop Syrian Slaughter." So then came Libya.
And early in 2011, the question was asked, what should the Security Council do about Libya? This was brought to the Security Council's attention by the Arab League that said a no-fly zone should be established to prevent the Gaddafi regime from overrunning rebel positions, overrunning the city of Benghazi, and murdering large fractions of the rebel population there. And remarkably, the Security Council decided to endorse and adopt, effectively, responsibility to protect, to allow air power to enter the Libyan airspace to try to protect the population. The United States and its NATO allies overextended this beyond that to overthrow the Gaddafi regime.
So this is cited, the Libyan intervention, as the reason why the Chinese and the Russians veto the recent UN efforts, Security Council efforts, to apply similar sanctions against the Assad regime, or at least to up the ante on the Assad regime. Now, is that true, or are there some other, you know, more self-serving motives here? I mean, as the UN, our UN rep in Susan Rice at the time of that vote said, she's disgusted with some of the members referring to Russia in particular, who are selling arms to the Syrian regime and have military bases and have clear interests, as opposed to this idea that somehow China and Russia got conned and burned by the West by what happened over Libya.
Mind you, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton likewise said recently that she's disgusted, very disgusted as well, about Russia's behavior. Now, the Russian position, at least formally, is that the application of responsibility to protect to Syria would be a slippery slope. And from the Russian point of view, they argue that there was a slippery slope in Libya. They say the resolution simply required or asked, mandated that the combatants, the air combatants, protect the civilian population in Libya, not overthrow the government. Now, in Syria, the Russians have an ally, and that's one rationale to protect the Syrian government. It is a Syrian ally of long standing. It receives the Syrians purchase arms from Russia. The Russians have a naval facility in Syria. Russia wants a stake in the Middle East, and Syria provides that. Remarkably, Russia endorses no action on the part of the Security Council at this time. But there's another reason, because the Russians and the Chinese, arguably, are looking in the mirror, and they say this is a slippery slope that could apply to us. If there's unrest in Russia or China in the future, some countries could claim that this responsibility to protect could or should be applied to Russia or China.
Well, so when the Russians were in, after all, it was Putin that started the second Chechen War,
yes,
and it was precipitated by the bombing of apartment buildings in the outskirts of Moscow, the details of which still remain mysterious to this day. Was there some kind of did we turn a blind eye? Was there a trade-off there? You know, you can go ahead and kill your own people. Why did we not make more of a fuss about what was happening in Chechnya at the time it was happening?
Well, mind you, the principle of responsibility to protect wasn't
in place
at the time.
Right.
And it just didn't reach the status that it has now in public discourse and dialogue.
No.
Clearly, you know, what happened in Chechnya was a tragedy. I'm of a view with regard to civil conflicts that governments should let their people go, essentially. Elements of population wish to segregate themselves from the homeland, so to speak, because they simply can't get along, then the consideration should be given to confederation, federation, or actually countries departing from the situation, or rather nationalities departing from the situation they find themselves in. Mind you, there have been countries that have broken themselves apart, such as the Soviet Union, such as Czechoslovakia, such as the former Yugoslavia, although that was done in a violent way. So there are precedents for this. Leaving that aside, the United States adhered to the doctrine, that is Article 2 of the UN Charter, which said, well, what happens within a country, we can object to it, we can raise all sorts of issues associated with it, but we cannot intervene. The Canadian 2001 initiative, however, raises to the fore again because of Rwanda and what happened in the former Yugoslavia.
Well, you know, obviously you're not going to get the Chinese to suddenly wake up one day and feel benevolent, say to the Tibetans, we're terribly sorry for the way we treated you.
Absolutely. So they're not going to endorse this, what they believe is a slippery slope. Right. They want adherence to Article 2 of the UN Charter.
So what then do you think can happen here in terms of R2P in the context of what's happening in Syria now? Is because the UN humanitarian representative is now the Syrians wouldn't let her in, and now even Russia and China are voting to force the Syrians to let her in. So something's happening there in terms of not so much responsibility to protect, but at least some credibility of the United Nations in terms of the humanitarian catastrophe that's taking place inside of Syria.
Well, in my article, I call for a fourfold policy. First, I think the Arab League should revisit their call for the removal of Assad. They should call for the removal of Assad and his ruling clique. After all, the regime is more than the leader. Second, I suggest that there should be, in a sense, a propaganda campaign directed at the Syrian military, encouraging them to defect to the rebel side, or by a date certain to avoid prosecution, join the rebels. Third, I call for covert military aid so resistors can contest Assad's infantry, armor, and helicopters. And fourth, foreign mediation to help mold the divided opposition into a united, internationally recognized government in waiting. So those are the options that I propose. Others have proposed others as well. But I don't think it's likely that the United States or other countries are going to intervene militarily. Syria is a quagmire. We're not going to get into another quagmire.
Well, but already there is an intervention. The Qataris have sent a force in. I believe the Turks are sending in a covert special operations force to work with the Free Syrian Army. There have even been some suggestions from Hillary Clinton that arms may find their way.
That's correct. She has said that. But as far as American intervention, American air power, I think it's unlikely. I think Syria poses greater challenges than Libya did, and there's limits, particularly in the presidential year, in terms of what the United States is willing to do.
Well, nobody's calling for them. You're not calling for them, right?
I am not. No, I'm not.
You're just saying that they can use some PSYOP methods of trying to influence the Syrian military to defect.
Yes, I believe that could be one strategy. I haven't heard anybody talk about that. That is propagandize the Syrian military to defect.
But what about the basis for the support for the Assad clique is still, there's a substantial number of people in Syria that support the Assads, particularly the minority Christians and other minorities, and the Alawites, of course, who are the ones that are meeting out all of the brutality, because there will be blood. There'll be retribution. There'll be revenge.
And well, that's why the government in waiting, as they call it, should be a broad-based government, not limited to one sect or the other, but should be representative of the entire population. I think that's critical.
Well, obviously the specter that's overshadowing this is what happened in Iraq, and surely that's informing the people who are supporting this regime, right, and particularly the Christians.
I'm not saying this is going to be easy, but I'm saying this is the cards we've been dealt. Syria is a multifaceted country in terms of populations and sects, and this has to be representative in a government that will succeed the Assad regime. But let me just add one other point. I mean, what happens in Syria is going to have implications for other circumstances where countries turn on their people. If we don't and are unable get rid of this particular regime, other dictators will say to themselves, well, we can hold out as well. This shouldn't be the mantra for this 21st century. There should be a change. You know, you listed all the cases of hundreds of thousands of people losing their lives while the world stood and watched. This can't be allowed in this 21st century. It's unconscionable.
Well, it is, and it's been that way for some time. And more often than not, we, out of frustration, we invoke sanctions, which end up punishing the people and not the dictators. And we've gone to war just to get rid of people like Saddam Hussein, and that's the collateral damage to the people has been morally unsupportable in terms of just getting rid of the dictator. So clearly, there's a terrible. Crying need for some kind of workable mechanism, and I guess you think, and it's probably the only place that could do it would be the UN, and you think R2P is the way to go.
Well, I think R2P is the way to go. I'm not saying things will work out smoothly. They haven't been working out particularly smoothly in Libya, but this takes time. This can take years to cobble together a new legitimated government. So we shouldn't ask more than is reasonable to expect when you have fractured societies that haven't been functioning effectively. It will take time, and that's what we can hope for in the Syrian case and, frankly, other cases as well.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Bennett Ramberg.
Thank you again.
Again, I've been speaking with Bennett Ramberg, who was formerly a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs at the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of the book Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy and Unrecognized Military Peril. And he has an article at Politico, The World Must Stop Syrian Slaughter. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.